to A Global Focus with guest Clifford Stone, Hawk researcher, retired U.S. Army sergeant, NCO, specialist, and decorated Vietnam combat veteran. Tonight's discussion will include Clifford's books and research findings entailing the UFO and ET subjects. Welcome back, everyone, to our discussion with Clifford Stone and Clifford's excellent books, of course. UFOs are real, extraterrestrial encounters documented by the U.S. government. He also has a prior outstanding book and his most recent book just released, Eyes Only, the story of Clifford Stone and UFO crash retrievals, with foreword by Robert Salas and introduction interviews by Paolo Leopizi Harris. Now, before we get back to this great conversation, I just wanted to note to our audience the excellent programs for Paranormal Radio Network, including UFO Undercover with host Joe Montaldo on Thursday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, and Second Sight, New York City, with a great pair of hosts, Chris George and Stephanie Benetti, on Thursday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, and on Friday immediately prior to this program, Through the Keyhole, with host and researcher Karen Dolan from 7 to 9 Eastern. Clifford, I am just so excited. Boy, I'd love to have you talking now for another 2 or 3 hours. There's so much information here, but I just wanted to preface this next section or segment with the comment you had made to me that really your message here is a positive one, and I know a concept that was noted, that was included rather, among the impressive points you made during your May 10th, 2001 disclosure testimony at the Disclosure Project meeting at the Washington, D.C. Press Club. Clifford, in that address you indicated that the ETs are living beings with families in their own respective cultures. Clifford, has this aspect of ET been apparent to you both during your life at large and also during the certain military assignments where you interfaced with ET?
Actually, that came into play when I was in my late teens.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started to have this, I'd always see them as children, just like me. And they'd always caution me, don't mention them because no one else could see them. And I thought, that's kind of foolish. I see them, you know, as solid people, you know. But they always caution me, no, others can't see us. They aren't meant to see us. But I had that little incident where a bird fell out of its nest, a little bird that just hatched out of an egg. And when it fell to the ground, it hit concrete and broke its beak. Well, I took it home, and I went ahead and I tried to hold it underneath the water. And you cut on your hand, that's what you did, and that's what a kid would do. And in the process of trying to help the bird, it actually drowned the bird. And I had taken up the life of another living thing, and that bothered me greatly. Well, at the time, I wasn't aware of it, but whatever I felt, the one entity that was to follow me throughout my life felt everything I felt, every emotion. So in a frenzy, he appeared to me and said, why do I feel what I'm feeling? Why do you feel the way you feel? And I was afraid, and yeah, I panicked. I ran, trying to find a place to hide. My mom was in the hospital at that time. My Aunt Wynn was taking care of me and my sister, and she didn't know what else was going on, and she thought I was just throwing a tantrum and trying to get me to sit in a chair, but I wasn't going to sit there. I ran. There was a space between the sink and the refrigerator, so I got back there. While I was back there, it was like this bony hand going across the top of my head, essentially telling me I can run, but I can't hide. I regained my composure, but now I was seeing the person as a child, and I was asking what happened there. And they let me know, you saw as I really look. You see me as another human person, then it's easier for you to accept that. And, you know, they were telling me that we choose people throughout your planet, and we stay with them for life. This way, we learn about the peoples of your planet. And, you know, again, get an understanding growing from there. Then we actually started to talk about his family and how he missed them. And he was picking up on me missing my family. Like, you know, my wife is a little different than I am. If she goes away, say to visit the kids for 2 or 3 weeks, I miss my wife a lot. Well, she thinks, well, you know, we're still together and all that. But in my life, you know, I have learned to accept we have today, no guarantee of tomorrow. So we have to make the best we can of this day. And you could sense that from them, too. Because sometimes they'd be here for weeks at a time. Now, when I say weeks at a time, you got to understand that for them to go back in real time, they may be, like in this instance, say 100 light years away. They can go back and forth, like going from here 100 light years away in real time as it passed here on Earth, about a month. So, you know, that's not exceeding the speed of light. That's actually traversable wormholes. And I caution people to be very careful, because the ultimate conclusion as to UFOs really are, and I shouldn't use the term UFOs because the Air Force doesn't like using UFOs, because everyone believes UFO, okay, that's an interplanetary spaceship. No, an ET craft is the best way to say it. An ET craft can navigate those traversable wormholes. And a lot of times, the phenomena itself, the living entities that come here, are not necessarily from a far-off, distant solar system. But a lot of times, there's interdimensional travel also. Now, at some point, yes, time travel gets involved in this. However, there's no interaction with the people who are doing the time traveling. Particularly from, a lot of people say, okay, they're coming from our future back to here. Well, if there's any interaction with that, there's a whole lot of things just from where we're at right now in our present time on Earth. If we could go back into the future, we would change things. But God in His infinite wisdom put up a natural barrier where you're not going to go back and change anything. Were that to happen, you would create a whole other universe in which whatever event you change as a result of that event, that universe would be different. You go back, stop the Second World War. Okay, you have a parallel universe. That now it's this, in which the Second World War never occurred. Whatever the aftermath of the Second World War not occurring, it will occur in that parallel universe. However, you have to come back to your universal reality. And in your universal reality, the Second World War occurred. So to stop that from happening, there's that natural barrier. So you can go back and be observers of the past, but you can't change anything in the past. I hope I'm making sense with what I'm trying to say there.
No, that's extremely intriguing. And here we've got our brilliant West Virginia director from ICAR noting that, I think she likes that concept, that idea of time travel. Also, before I mention a question from Cobb, our great Northeast policeman here, who also has great questions as to sci all the time. It's a blessing for me. I just had two really brief questions. That individual whom you believe has been monitoring you throughout your life is named Corona, correct?
Yeah, and something unique about that, I mean,
yes.
When he told me his name, he says, it's Corona with a K. I don't know what the significance of K is, but it was important for me to understand that it's spelt with a K.
And did I ask correctly that at one point he did eventually show himself to you with his actual appearance, but at one point did he appear as a large white owl?
Oh, that was out where I worked.
Mm-hmm. And yes,
I can't,
the job corps.
It was him that appeared, but it was him because the kids were asking. They'd love to see an E.T.
Mm-hmm.
And his question was, if you saw one, would you know what you were seeing? And the folks I was talking to went ahead, oh, well, of course, we would. Well, the response was, we'll see. Well, we're still talking there, and we have a smoke shed there, and we look up, and we see this big white owl, which at the time we thought, well, that's strange, seeing it over there, so we started to walk toward it. And it was a good 150 feet away, which means you shouldn't have been able to see it. But as we got closer, it flew off. So we followed it back behind some of the buildings there on our compound. And then it landed on the ground. And as we started to approach it, it had a pinkish albino eyes, you know, like pinkish red. Yet, the owl was white, and as we got closer, all of a sudden, everyone started, wait a minute, owls get that big? Well, this one was about 3 foot tall, and when we got within maybe 50 feet of it, it flew off again. But for 3 days, that owl was there. Then as mysteriously as it showed up, it disappeared. So for 3 days, people would see it, but only at night. One of the folks went ahead, he called me Pops. We were out and said, anybody see the owl? And no, it's gone. And he told me, he says, you know, I had permission to stay up late last night, and we searched and searched for white owls. And there are white owls, but none that big. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, it was an owl, right? He said, yes, it appeared to be an owl. I said, okay, what do you think it was? He says, Pops, we saw an E.T., didn't we? And I actually never answered the question fully, but I'm quite sure that that right there is what they saw. And there was other incidences that occurred there. Even one young lady wrote a report about the incident, and I still don't feel good about releasing that yet, but I'm thinking, as I told you yesterday,
mm-hmm.
it's something that somebody, that people need to see. And I'll even carry it one step further. It's perfectly natural for children to have make-believe playmates. And the children clearly recognize this is a make-believe playmate. But if a child is coming up and saying, no, Mom, no, Dad, this person's real. You just can't see him. Don't go ahead and think that that child is necessarily having some type of mental breakdown or an illusion. Sure, be concerned about that, you know, but don't immediately jump to that conclusion. Because like with me, my mom and dad would tell me, oh, no, it's just a make-believe playmate. No, Mom, no, Dad, it's not. You don't understand? I don't understand. But we carried on conversations. Today we even had that. It's okay to talk to yourself, but if you answer yourself, you got a problem. So, you know, I was telling my family, look, I ask questions, answer. And it's not something that's just made up in my mind. But I do remember getting to the point, because it was something I could not deny. Even with the other kids, I could not say, you know, these things aren't going on. So, yeah, it did open you up for ridicule. But even with the ridicule, I knew how to stop it. All I had to do was say, you know what? This isn't real. The joke's on you. You believe me when I said that. I could not bring myself to do that. because I knew what was going on was real.
And you had playmates who actually saw, or young children playing with you who actually saw these beings too.
Oh, yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, in the book, I talk about the time they were showing me some stuff and made it clear they didn't want no one else out there. And the one that went ahead and through the window into the garage, because he went and got my mom, because he saw what he thought was a man in there with me. And his name was Delbert Hudson. And he went and got my mom and brought over some more of my friends, and they were beating on the door. I says, "I'm okay, just go away. I'll be out shortly." And he said, "No, I saw somebody there. I know there's somebody in there with you." I says, "There's no one here with me. I'm by myself." And he came in through the window and it broke the sink and it flooded the whole downstairs of the garage we had back there. And he came on upstairs, but as soon as he made it to the top of the stairs, it flashed. I mean, you know, like, poof, the energy was gone. And the things I was being shown, they're gone too. And he says, "Who was here with you?" I says, "No one." And he says, "Nah, Stoney, I saw someone." I smiled, and I said, "You saw something." And he went ahead. He never wanted to talk about that. But at no time when it was brought up did he ever deny that he saw another person there with me. But he felt comfortable saying another person. He didn't want to think about it being something else. So he saw that. And that statement, as a matter of fact, that the young lady wrote out there where I worked, she saw something too, her and her cousin. And there were about 20 other kids. But she felt so compelled to write a statement and report it. So she made an official statement. When I'll say my supervisor talked to me, said, "What do I do with this?" And I said, "Well, what do you need to do with it?" He says, "Did this happen?" And I told him that. I said, "I'm not going to say the young lady's lying or she's having illusions. But did this happen?" And I said, "What do you think?" Well, he believed that these things did happen. So he went ahead and said, "Here, handle this." So I got the report, and I didn't want the young lady's name to be drawn through the mud. So I never did anything with the report, but I did keep it. And that helps for me to check on my sanity from time to time. Then I had a friend who I served with in Germany when I first got there, and it was in 76, and we hadn't seen one another for years. But with the 1997 book, when it came out, he first saw Stanton Freeman's DVD that's entitled UFOs Are Real. And he went on, because he sells things over eBay. He went and tried to do a search to see if there was more stuff out there that he could get and resell over eBay. Then he found my book, and it was by Sergeant Clifford E. Stone. So he thought, was that the same person? So he went and he found where they had a picture of me, and he knew it was me. And you care if I read a part of, I can't read the whole letter, it's 7 pages.
Oh, go right ahead.
But I'm going to read 2 paragraphs.
Please do.
And forgive me if I get emotional, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But in it, paraphrasing here, we talked a bit about UFOs, but Cliff had evidently had some bad experiences in the past. So this was not a common topic of discussion. He often grew fugitive when the topic came up. I knew though what was always in Cliff's briefcase when he pulled C2. And the other paragraph was, we also talked about his time in Vietnam. He's seen things, not the kind of things combat veterans don't like to talk about, but interesting things nonetheless. The powers that be is one thing we had discussed. Typically, the response given to a soldier who was about to blow the whistle on some item that would embarrass command would be to punish the soldier in an attempt to silence him. In Cliff's case, it was being sent out in the field in hopes perhaps that he would be killed. I have seen this type of behavior before, more often than not. One of the last conversations I had with Sergeant Stone, I asked him, Cliff, what are you doing here? You're not just a normal soldier. Normal soldiers don't take notes about everything. They don't like congressmen. They don't carry photographs of UFOs. So don't tell me. I don't want to know. But tell me this. Will I ever see any of it? I stated, once again, quote from the letter, you might see some of it. He said cryptically, with and still see to this day. Now, he only was with me for about 6-7 months. But in that time, a whole lot of the soldiers I was assigned there knew I was doing something, but didn't know what. And I wasn't openly talking about it at that time. I went ahead, and because I was getting stuff, I always referred to it as hobby. Well, with him working with 40th Postal, all over mail came in there. So I was getting registered mail, certified mail. And I'd have to sign snowflakes as though I was receiving classified information. But it was under FOIA, but I was getting information that you're normally not going to get under FOIA. And I'd have to have it sanitized at some later time so I could have it as what I have it in the book now. But not all the things I was receiving back then was that way. It was fully visible. I could see everything there. But I'd always have to get it by virtue of it being considered of a classified nature. I'd always have to get it as registered mail or certified mail. And he knew that FOIA requests did not work that way. They paid the lowest amount of postage as possible. First class, get it to you. They did not go and register it. They did not go and certify it. But much of what I was getting, that's the way I received it. Particularly in the October-November overflights along the eastern coast of the United States, the information I was getting on that came that way. But he knew that. He got to see things. He got to see strange people come and talk to me, and always in civilian clothes, but enough to know that even some of the brass would be nervous when some of those people were there. And I do know that anytime we went out on a mission there in Germany, there was some element at V Corps that was fully appraised of what was going on. Because when they went ahead and my family got there, like I said, they got there on a Friday. I had to leave on a Monday, and I went and told our executive officer that, no. My family just got here. This isn't right. And he told me, he said, Sergeant Stone, you don't understand. We didn't go and say, okay, we're going to send you. They wanted you by name. Now, I got a letter of appreciation from the Department of Army Inspector General for that mission, but it doesn't state what I was doing. But I do have the letter. And when I to the assignment, they immediately told us, you have to have a secret clearance. Well, I very proudly went up to the colonel who was in charge of the operation. And this was an Army colonel. This really was. It's not the one that always called the colonel. I went up and said, "Sir, regretfully, I have to stand down from this mission. I don't have a security clearance, sir." He looked at me and smiled. He said, "Sergeant Stone, I know that if we were here facing an enemy, and here and fight to the death, I know you would lay down your life for your country. And we're here, you're here, I need you. And a little formality, if you not having a security clearance isn't going to make me come up with a decision, I'm going to send you back to your unit and try to get someone else. There is no one else. You're here. You're part of this operation. And I have complete confidence in your loyalty and patriotism to do the right thing. Please note, not to keep our secrets, but to do the right thing." And what I didn't know at the time, I had a security clearance. It was given to me when I first went into basic, and it stayed with me. Anybody out there knows that you have to renew your security clearance every 5 years. And first, you have to have a need for a security clearance where your security office, or in many of our cases, the SPO, the Security Plans and Operations Office, will do the paperwork and submit you for a security clearance. Now, if you were assigned to a unit where you didn't need a security clearance, that security clearance was pulled. Not mine. It always stayed with me, but at a secret level. With that being said, there is emergency conditions where they can up that security clearance on a one-time basis. The problem I had from that security clearance, if it was something that was higher than secret, or that event, I now had a security clearance higher than secret. But it always had to originate from that security clearance. And yes, I have proof that I had that secret clearance all the way through. Because when I started to query the various agencies as to what they had on me, dealing with my involvement in UFOs, the DIA sent me back a notice that, "Well, we have one page on you reflecting that you were given a security clearance under AR of secret under Army Regulation 50-5, which is the Nuclear Authority Regulation. The one that the Army Security Agency sent back, ASA, it stated that, yes, I had a secret security clearance in accordance with Army Regulation 50-5 and Army Regulation 380-380 considered. Well, we used, for lack of a better term, I'll say a laptop computer, which you had to have a secret clearance to use that computer. But you also had to be cleared to use the computer by that regulation. So I have this stuff. I can prove that this is the case, and they also reflect back that it was in July of 1968 when the security clearance was given to me. When I got assigned here to the New Mexico Military Institute with the U.S. Army Detachment there, ROTC Detachment, they tried to pull that security clearance because I didn't have a need for it. They could not pull it. It remained in effect. I still had the security clearance. Now, At that time, it was open. I was doing this. And there was also when I was put with a working group where I was the only one in the working group that had the active top secret clearance. And I have that one page that reflects that. But the whole situation is, one, I never requested a security clearance. So I should not have had it until I requested it. In an assignment where you might need it, fine. Then you'd hit up on it. When I was in Vietnam, we'd get a code book every month for the radios that would give the alternate frequencies and all this and the code words by various units. And every month that would change. And that was a confidential book. And I'd always said back, gee, don't you think I should have a security clearance if I'm working with this stuff, at least confidential? And, you know, I know one of my officers, Captain Pelton, questioned that, and he was told, you know, when it comes to Sergeant Stone, don't worry about it. He's got what he needs. And that's where it ends. There's no discussion. But in 1987, I finally found out that I had a secret clearance from within 30 days of me getting into the military, before I ever got out of basic, all the way up to, and I think it was February 1987. But I never once ever had to renew that clearance. And by regulation, law, everything, every 5 years you have to renew it for it to remain active. And like I say, I got the documentation to prove what I'm saying.
Because there you go.
Anybody that's been in the military will find that also very hard to believe. But now Paul has seen that. That documentation. Captain South, I sent him stuff that a lot of people never did see. Because initially, I went ahead and I told Captain Salas that when he told Paula he'd be more than happy to do the introduction to my book. And I called him and I said, sir, you know, a lot of people don't believe me, and I don't want to hurt people. And I said, you know, your story's important. And I know it to be true what you went through. And I just don't want, if you write it, then, you know, they're going to go ahead and try to drag you through the mud, too. And he said, with all due respect, Sergeant Stone, I think that's my decision and my concern. You don't have to be concerned about that. But then I went ahead, and Paula was nice enough to come down here with another young man. They were from Phoenix. And I pulled out some stuff, and we went, made the copies. Paula made another copy and sent to him so he could go over that stuff so he could see. And I wanted him to have a copy of that stuff because, like I say, this was information. There's a whole lot of information no one had ever seen there. And it was several hundred pages, but I wanted him to see it. And I guess what I wanted was for him to say, you know what? Boy, he can't prove everything he's saying. Here's circumstantial evidence. And one of the big issues I had was that I was a clerk typist. The only thing in my records that reflects that I went got any type of training by one of the naysayers was my records reflect I got clerk typing school. Yep, I didn't see a typewriter while I was there, neither. And that I went through something called Head Start. Well, that was a week-long program in Germany where they teach you the anemones of having an active station with the German people, with little German phrases, things of this sort, and where you could order a meal in a German restaurant. What that person didn't have was my microfiche that had the 2-1 on it that reflected that I had 80 semester hours of law enforcement training from the military police school. What that individual didn't have was the EER that's in the book, by the way, which
there's extensive documentation in the book, both books.
Mm-hmm. That states that I was an expert, among other things, in NBC, nuclear, biological, chemical warfare. And they normally didn't include that, but this person knew I was an expert in it. So he went ahead and he included that. And I'm glad he did, because Paula herself was the one that found that and decided it should be in the book because she knew that was one of the big systems people had of me. Short of my typewriter getting contaminated in an NBC environment, what do I need NBC for? Individual training, everybody gets that. But to Habit Retard? Uh-uh. It's a given. You know how to don a protective mask. You know how to use the decontamination kit, the individual decontamination kit. But that doesn't make you an expert. That doesn't make you proficient in NBC. You're proficient when you go to a school. And, yes, it was necessary for me to go to that school because it was always initially an NBC event if we got discovered. You'd always have two teams. You'd have A team and B team. The A team, the A response team had to be on site within 2 hours. The B team, the backup team, had to be there within four. So, how many people they had that could do interface, I don't know. I do know they had very few.
You definitely
I do know
mm-hmm.
we're actively trying. And, like, I was medically rejected from military service right there at Fort Hays. 6 months later, I managed to get in.
Yes, you did very, very well on the tests. And you even graduated. I'm sorry, you enrolled before you graduated.
I tried to enroll before I graduated. I tried to get in. That's when they found out I was medically disqualified. I got a draft notice later on to go back to be reevaluated. So I went back, and they gave me a choice. They told me there, do you want to go ahead and be drafted or enlist? And I said, I don't mind enlisting. And, of course, the captain there, that was the doctor that was going to sign off on my paperwork, that I still was not physically qualified for military service. There was a colonel there, and he told him, go ahead, take his family to Camden Park, which is a park there in Huntington, West Virginia. And this was Ashland, Kentucky, where I was going in, the Armed Forces Entrance Examination Station there. And the colonel flat out asked me, you really want to go into the military? And, of course, being young and fully believing my country could do no wrong, and at the time, fully believing that we were right being in Vietnam, and we had guys going over there that didn't believe, and they were dying, I felt that I had an obligation to put my money where my mouth was, and that was to serve my country in the military. And I told him, no, sir, I don't have any inhibition going in. Where do I sign? He says, you volunteering? I said, yes, sir. And he went ahead. He says, okay, 4th of July weekend. So if you're getting drafted, you're leaving right there. You're not going back home. But if you're volunteering, he says, I want you to go home over the weekend. Then I want you to come back here on July the 8th. And then we'll go ahead and do your paperwork. We'll send you on to basic.
Well, apparently your entrance exam scores were very, very high. And I just wanted to note here as well, the excellent documentation in both books, there are even notes there that note your observation of a wormhole. Really fascinating. And before I turn it, just too quick, but one, well, very thought-provoking experiences of yours on your mission, onto special missions there in Vietnam. I wanted to note a room question here from our Northeast policeman. He is a Vietnam veteran from the U.S. Marine Corps. And just some questions there. Would you have any idea what happens to the materials from the crashes? And he's wondering if you had received any information regarding NHJ Trong 1966 in June when a UFO brightened the area or that Fort Benning, Georgia incident. He thinks it's around 1977, but regardless, he wants to congratulate you for your excellent work. And also, of course, he's a fellow Vietnam veteran. He, though, is from the U.S. Marine Corps, where you were from the Army.
Well, we were brothers in arms, you know. And
yes.
I appreciate his service to our great country. But, yeah, the one in Iran, that was September 1976, I think, is what he's talking about.
Right, Parviz Jafari, yes, and right, over Iran.
And
mm-hmm.
now all we got was all intelligence data. The DIA, the paperwork they have on it, made it clear that this was a significant case. We needed to get more information.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we say we didn't. The three-page telex that talks about the incident says we didn't. But in actually both of my books that have documentation in them, there's a document entitled, Now You See It, Now You Don't.
Mm-hmm.
And the prefix to that article, which was in an Air Force intelligence journal, and it was classified secret at one time, makes it clear that sometime in the career of a military pilot,
mm-hmm.
they're going to see things that are not going to be, they are not going to be able to explain, and that will not be able to be explained away, even after careful evaluation. And, yes, we got more out of there. But that stuff, once again, is a finalized intelligence product that has never seen the light of day. And in there, there's also the Pine Capsule, 78 in my book. It's got the documents there, but the public affairs officer made it clear he'd never been a believer in UFOs. But he knows that the people who were involved in that incident saw something very strange that night. And the case went away. No one tried to go ahead and try to provide any answers. And the reason he said that they didn't do that, there was no way they could duplicate the phenomena that was observed that night. And that is in my first book. And I had CDs. But my first book is hard, first and second book, both of them are hard to find. But my door is never locked to anyone that comes here. And if people come here, if I have an extra CD, any documentation I have that a person would like to have, I will make them copies free of charge. Sometimes I don't have the CDs, so they might have to bring their own CDs. But I have never turned anyone away from my door.
You're a dedicated researcher with the best intent. Clifford, do we have time here for you just to mention two really outstanding missions in Vietnam? One was regarding when there was an attempt to retrieve a crashed B-52. You found on the scene, or you encountered ETs on the scene. The ETs were not responsible for downing the craft. That was enemy fire. But your impressions on that, and also, I don't know if it was the same incident where there was there were signs of very advanced tech regarding a cave, and where you thought the ETs might have helped to repair your eyesight due to an injury.
Those are separate mm-hmm. incidents.
Okay, thank you.
One with the B-52, that was long before I went to Vietnam on assignment.
And you left from Florida. Yes, please, details on that first. Thank you.
Well, now, we're told we were going to Florida.
Uh-huh.
We actually left there from Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. we're supposed to be going on what's called an FTX, a field training exercise, in Florida. So we got on the plane, but, you know, it seemed like an awful long flight. We sat down for refueling, which kind of seems strange. Why did we sit down for refueling? But they told all of us we have to stay on the plane, which isn't normal practice. Normally, if they're going to refuel, everybody gets off the plane. But we stayed there, and one guy looked out and said, if this is an Oakland, I'll kiss your hindsight. And the guy that I always called the colonel pulled out his .45 and said, next person that says anything, I will personally shoot. You'll be briefed once we're airborne again, but not before. So everyone, wow, this is extreme. Why is this going on? But, you know, you could have heard a church mouse. But when we got airborne again, and several hours after being airborne, they told us that we were going into a territory that wasn't friendly to the U.S. and that everybody was handpicked for specific reasons. But we had a B-52 that went down there. And it was important for us to check that B-52 out. And, of course, we could have nuclear weapons on that aircraft. Well, when we landed, now this was a commercial aircraft. It wasn't a military that was taking us over there. No flight crew. You had pilots. And you had military was providing, like, you know, coffee, things of that sort. You had sea rations. You wasn't getting no airline meals on that aircraft. But an hour or two before we landed, we were given a plastic bag. And it had a piece of tape on it. We were to write our name on it. Then we would take everything out of our pockets, put it into the plastic bag. We were to take where our uniforms had, we had the batiks back in those days, the green batiks. But we had to cut off where it said U.S. Army. We had to cut our name tag off. We had to go ahead, cut our chevrons off it, told what our rank was, and put everything in that bag. And that stayed on the aircraft when we got out. But when we got out, there were two helicopters that was waiting for us. And it was at the end of the flight line. And I didn't know where we were at the time, but I know for sure that it was Benoit that we landed at. We got into the helicopters, and it seemed like better than an hour we were airborne. Then when we landed at what we called the staging area, we left some things there, even set up a tent. We then had to go on into the jungle area.
And this was Vietnam?
There was this cleared out area.
Was this in Vietnam?
This was in, I firmly believe it was Cambodia.
Okay, sorry.
But, you know, Cambodia is right next to Vietnam. And Benoit is Vietnam. It's in two-core area. But just like some giant hand that set the B-52 down there on the jungle floor. Well, it had just gotten to be daylight, and we're going around looking at the craft. And as I get around to the tail section of the aircraft, for lack of a better term, a typical graze came up from behind there, and one of them looked me dead in the eye, and I'm looking, and it says, "Cliff Ford, what are you doing here? You are not supposed to be here." And I know this is going to sound crazy. I have no idea why I said what I said and why I did what I did. And I'm not even sure if I was the first one to shoot. I brought my M16 down yelling, "VC, VC," and I started fire. And, you know, we started back off. Now, they wasn't running after us. They were at a fast-paced walk following us for a short distance. But our bullets was having no effect on them. We got back to this little stream, and it came up almost to about knee level. We went back over, and that right there was where our staging area was, where we had our tents set up. And we got back over there. Then the guy that I always called the colonel, he said, "We're going back over there, and you got to be crazy." He says, "Nope." He says, "You know where we are, Sergeant Stone?" I said, "Well, sir, I can tell you we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto." He says, "Well, you got that right." So we went back over, and we recovered the bodies, and they put them in a helicopter and took them on out. But then they brought in some engineers, and they brought in security to secure the area because, once again, this was not Vietnam, and we be in Cambodia. So I guess I have to say, I believe we were in Cambodia, but I don't know that for sure. Anyhow, they cut the wing sections off of the B-52 up to the fuselage on both sides of the fuselage. They cut the tail section of the B-52 off. And they had what they called CH-64 sile cranes to come in and pick up each section of the aircraft and fly them back. Now, I know they flew them back, the pieces, back to the United States. Only thing I could see that brought that aircraft down was the possibility of flak from an explosion of, say, a SAM-7 or something like that. There was no signs of death rays or anything like that. The bodies had wounds on them that was consistent with all kinds of shrapnel in the aircraft.
A human weapon.
There were several penetration holes that clearly indicated that it wasn't an exotic weapon of our visitors. And we fairly, all of us fairly well figured out that it was SAMs that brought them down. And the intel officer was doing a report on the aircraft itself, and they were taking photographs of it also. He was hitting up on the fact that that's what it was, that it was, in fact, SAM missiles that brought it down. No hostile intent as a result of the bogeys. Now, bogeys is a term that they use for an unidentified aircraft assumed to be hostile. But it was also a term that we used to identify UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
We actually got to the point, and I have the document from 1969, where in January of 69, they started to see an increase in UFO sightings in the two core area. And the adjacent with both Laos and Cambodia. Now, with them seeing this, they concluded, well, they might be helicopters of the North Vietnamese. I never saw a communist helicopter while I was there. Now, with that being said, I did see PT-76s, which are lightweight Soviet tanks, but they were taken up very, very quickly, thanks to things like A-10s, F-4s. They didn't last long. But the whole situation is, we took them out of there. And we took them back someplace. Now, when the crafts crashed, I can tell you right now, the initial sight that everything went too early on. And there, the initial field exploitation would take place. Please note I said the initial field exploitation. They do not stay at Wright-Patterson. A lot of people say it's Area 51, Site 4. I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know one thing. Edwards Air Force Base plays a key role, even to this day, when it comes to UFOs. There was the USS Turner who saw where a UFO went down. The cover story was that it was a nose capsule from one of our test flights that had a mouse in it. Well, we recovered that, and we took it right there to Edwards Air Force Base. With it being there at Edwards Air Force Base, the field exploitation team from the Air Tactical Intelligence Center flew to Edwards, and I have no knowledge of that item ever leaving there. However, that was not a U.S. nose capsule with a mouse in it. Once again, the finalized intelligence product has yet to surface. I can name several hundred cases in which objects of unknown origin were recovered. I can show you the documentation, the raw field intelligence messages, where it was recovered. But anytime somebody goes to get that material, it comes up missing. When the Air Force did their report to make a preemptive strike on Congressman Schiff's effort to get what happened here in Roswell, they were afforded to see all kinds of classified information to include CSI. There was a lieutenant and there was a major. And, of course, they think all of us in the UFO field are full of hooey. But I believe them to be honest men. With saying that, I would have to say, I have to tell you, they know nothing of moon dust and blue fly. The because they did not get exposure to that material. Had they gotten exposure to that material, as it deals with the objects of unknown origin, not all, but some of that raw intelligence data would reflect that we have recovered alien spacecraft that did not originate on the face of this planet. A lot of what I said, I can't prove about my involvement. I never planned to prove it. I planned to carry it to my grave. I saw other people hurting, and I knew what I was going through with the family, with my own family. And I thought, this is all wrong. So all I can do is say, I know it to be true. I lived it. I went through it. And now, by me sharing my experiences, with me coming out and making it look like I'm crazy, and I don't care, with me coming out and I get to help other people, if it's only one or two, then my efforts aren't in vain. I have this old adage, if I make one person's life a little easier this day, I haven't lived this day in vain. If I have changed someone's life for the better, then I have not lived my life in vain. What I like working with the kids, I love those kids out there at Job Corps. They wasn't bad kids. They aren't bad kids. These kids are really good kids, but you know, yeah, you work with them, you get to see it. They'll build walls up around them. They'll build barriers. But these are really good kids. Really good, honest people who have happened to have an experience of high change, high strangeness.
Yes.
Their lives have changed forever. And we try to say, oh, they were mistaken. Yet they know what they saw. It's time for more people, not just me, people who even have more proof, to come forward and say, I was involved in this stuff, and this is the truth. And it's happening slowly. People say, well, disclosure is right around the corner. I don't know that to be true. I don't know whether we're going to get disclosure next year or 25 years from now. But the day is approaching when we're going to have that one event occur where there are going to be so many people involved, we can no longer keep it quiet. But in the interim, we have people out there. You know some. I know some. Anybody out there who knows more than 10 people knows somebody that has had UFOs impact their life and don't really know how to deal with it. So my message is, you know, these people had experiences. We need to recognize that. We need to stop the ridicule in social circles and understand, whether you believe in UFOs or not, this person experienced something that had an impact on their life. Then try to understand. Always, always have that degree of skepticism, but have it with an open mind and check the records. Study the records. Pursue the truth. And I honestly believe the truth will set you free. Above all, let no one live in your mind rent-free. And when it comes to governments, the same thing. Like, I see a lot of history being taught in schools that we accept as being valid by virtue of seeing formerly classified documents about the Second World War, having read the entire Pentagon Papers, which was a top-secret study of Vietnam, all the way from 1944 to 1968, I can tell you that what we're teaching in schools, a lot of it isn't true.
And may I ask you a question? We have 1 minute left, or about 2 minutes left. Clifford, would you say that from your experiences, you have witnessed technology that's truly majorly advanced? And as far as your missions, did they entail a worldwide scope, would you say? Or could you at least know that there were several missions in different locations? Well, were they truly worldwide, and was the advanced technology such, and the appearance of the ET such, that it just was a definitive example of their presence and their technology as well?
They've been here for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
At some times in our past, they even made open contact with various civilizations. They have made contact with some of the heads of state here within our own time. But the technology was so advanced, it would appear magic to us. But it's technology.
Mm-hmm.
And there is interaction among nations, even nations during the Cold War that were enemies, because they knew if this was turned out to be any part hostile, we would have to unite for the common good of the peoples of the world. We would have to end our bickering to defend mankind against the threat from space. But as all agencies say, which is very key, there has been no evidence of any hostile intent by any reported investigated UFOs by any of the military. With that being said, the second conclusion they reach is totally false. They have indicated threat, or they have indicated advanced technology. And that within itself makes it a potential threat. Therefore, the Boehner memo done in 69 is correct. We don't need Blue Book, because those cases that affect national security would still continue to be investigated, and they were never meant to be part of Blue Book.
Very powerfully said. Now, at this point, we have to conclude the show because we have our Kevin Smith show following directly thereon. Please, Clifford, I hope so much you'll be a return guest. We very much appreciate your comments this evening, a great deal of insight there and detail. Sir, thank you so much. Did you have about 10 seconds of a final comment there? Thank you so much.
Keep an open mind and search for the truth. And mm-hmm. Please, when people say they've had an experience, don't be so quickly to judge.
Mm-hmm.
And be so quickly to ridicule. Because today we are seeing UFOs. Tomorrow we're going to be reaching for the stars. Day after tomorrow we become somebody else's UFOs.
Wonderfully said. Thank you so much, Clifford. And again, his books are excellent. And thank you so much, audience, for listening, and also for our visitors and researchers in the room. Great weekend, everyone.
God bless everyone.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this evening on A Global Focus with guest Clifford Stone. Your time is appreciated. I wish you all a great weekend.